This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 13 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode, we have the return of Shiva's Vessel to present part 2 of her series on poly. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome back to another episode of the Kinky Cast. Sitting across the table from me is the Beast. How you doing, Beast? Oh, there's nobody across the table. Well, there is, but it's not the Beast. He called in under the weather tonight. Sitting across the table from me is Shiva's Vessel, back from episode 3.
Hello.
When you were here before, in episode 3, we were talking about consensual non-monogamy. What's on the agenda tonight?
We're going to keep going with that topic. We are going to talk about other aspects of it, though. We're going to talk about how we maintain a relationship once we go there.
Ooh, that sounds like fun. But you've been invisible for the past few weeks. What have you been doing?
I've been doing an academic roadshow, so to speak.
Okay, now that sounds like fun with a question mark.
I've been presenting at academic conferences.
Well, then that makes you a scholar, researcher, and something of an expert.
And also a participant. Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. So what do you find at these conferences?
A lot of very upstanding, vanilla scholars who are curious but afraid to ask too many questions about the topic of alternative relationships.
Vanilla in something you present. That's interesting.
I've actually had people approach me and say, I would love to have come to your paper, but I couldn't be seen there because people will get the wrong idea.
Well, everybody in a kinky audience has whips and chains and things.
Right. I told her, well, maybe next year I'll put a crop on the table.
There you go. Tonight we're talking about poly. What is poly?
We started out talking about consensually non-monogamous relationships, and that encompasses a lot of relationships. We're going to use the shorthand poly, which means many, because poly relationships encompass lots of different kinds of relationships. It can include everything from people who are monogamish, just a little bit non-monogamous, and only when the occasion strikes and it happens to be okay with all the partners involved. Or it can be a polyamorous relationship where there are deep feelings, deep ties, multiple partners. It can be a polyfidelity relationship, which is a closed poly group that does not participate outside of their circle, like a group marriage. Or it can be a polykink relationship where there's also power exchange occurring. It may be swing. But all of those are the same in the sense that they're all consensually non-monogamous. All the partners know and all the partners agree to have an open relationship.
Okay, well, that's a good explanation because people use the term poly rather loosely.
Yes, they do. And they often use it even to include very casual sex, meetups, hookups, and cheating. And actually, very loosely, those things can be included, but there's one element missing in a lot of those, and that is consent from all parties.
Which is a follow-up to episode 3 on consensual non-monogamy.
Correct. For it to be truly consensually non-monogamous, everybody has to know what's going on.
How do you determine whether participants are poly-prepared?
We often find that poly relationships are not something that we plan. Often, the partners involved have been in a monogamous relationship, and they decide to open up their relationship. And in doing so, they may seek opportunities or seek experiences. And as they go out and seek those experiences, they meet other people. And those other people are attractive in many different ways. And that is generally how we begin to see a poly relationship develop. Because of proximity, you surround yourself with people who are open, and those people then may become attractive to you. You enter into some kind of relationship with them, either alone or as a part of a group. And then if those go very well, you may continue them for a longer period of time. There are some characteristics that you might want to talk about, though, when you're looking at being poly-prepared. Just because we meet somebody and we're attracted to them does not mean they may be a good poly-partner for us. Poly-partnerships are dependent on a lot of factors, and those factors typically include, I call it the get-along factor. There are a lot of factors that are part of the get-along factor.
Well, including friendship.
Friendship is a big part of it, because if everyone's not friendly, you're already off to a bad start. I've told you generally how people meet and experience the getting to know each other part of poly, where they're in proximity to each other and they're becoming acquainted. Taking it to the next level is often done very casually. That's why sometimes we get into situations where we're in trouble, because there are a lot of disharmonies. It's important, if you really want something to last, that you do a little pre-qualifying with your partners, just like you would in any kind of relationship. You want to know a little bit about what makes them tick and how they fit with the dynamic you already have. And so I've come up with a list of characteristics you may want to consider when you're looking at entering into a poly relationship with someone or bringing somebody into an existing circle. And some of the things you might want to think about is, you know, does the person that you desire to bring in have a good understanding of what poly is? Have they ever been involved in any kind of poly relationship? Is the only experience they have with poly what they've read in a book in 50 Shades of Grey?
So you hope to find somebody that's at least trained a little bit in poly.
Or at least open and has some desires to explore it.
And understand
it. And understand it, yes. If they have had experience, it's really important to know what that experience is. Is it a good experience? Was it a negative experience? Someone I spoke to not too long ago was telling me that they were poly, and they started to talk about what negative experiences they had had with poly. Well, I'm sure if they were entering into a relationship with somebody or several people, that they would want to explore those negative experiences, because there could be reasons why those negative experiences happened that they can't control, or their experience with those problems may have been something that's inside of them that they need to fix before they enter into another poly type relationship.
I've met a number of people that say, oh yeah, I'm poly, which is just saying the words and not going through any of the steps to actually be it.
The other thing about that is that you do have some people that enter into a poly dynamic and they're bringing a lot of baggage with them, and you at least need to know what that baggage is before they come in, because it may be okay, or there could be some deal breakers there for everybody. The new person coming in, and also the people that are already in that situation. There is the whole problem with new relationship energy when you're starting a poly relationship of any kind, and that can cause you to just kind of go off the rails with these pre-qualifying aspects of things. You may find that you're so enamored with that person, or they're so enamored with you, that they, number one, will agree to whatever you say, and number two, you would not list your conditions or explain your own parameters because you don't want to lose that person. So that can be a really dangerous component. And then there are all the visions that that person may have of what poly consists of. One of the things I try to do is ask people, what does poly look like to you? How would you see it on a day-to-day basis? Would you see it as an idealized situation? Do you envision getting up in the morning and who's going to cook breakfast? I mean, it's as simple as that. Sometimes you need to look at all aspects of it, not just the sex, the love, the cuddles, but also the garbage, the laundry, the vacuuming,
paying the bills, taking
the dog for a walk, all of that. And also maybe taking responsibility for children if there are children involved, and how you're going to deal with that. The next piece of this, which is, I think, really critical, is once you've kind of gotten past those first hurdles, the practicalities of things like how we deal with space, money, stress, disappointment, losses, all of those things factor in. Are you going to live in one house together? Are you going to all have your separate spaces? Are you going to have one person in one place and two people in another? That will all affect the dynamic that you have. And then, you know, there are aspects of things like, how do you feel about change? Because poly relationships, they change a lot. Frequently, and sometimes you're not in control of what influences them.
There's so many personalities in the mix that people that are used to just two people are going to find that adding a third does not add just a third to the complexity.
Exactly. Fairness is a huge topic. It's like a little landmine. You know, having an idea what the relationship participants all feel about what's fair. How do you view fairness? How do you make things fair? And we'll talk more about that later. But finally, you really almost have to look at a personal definition of poly. Everybody's is a little different. And that's really important. It's really important for everybody to know what poly means to them. Because if they don't agree, and you have one definition of poly, and I have another one, and they're far apart, the words are meaningless because you've got to bridge the gap between them. And you can do that, but you have to find, first of all, the starting point.
And then making sure that all parties are on that same page.
Right. Because we're going to talk about equity, and equity is one of the driving factors in making these relationships work. And equity is dependent on knowing what your starting point is.
When three people get together in a poly relationship, what are the deal breakers?
Very much depends on the three people that are involved, what those deal breakers may be. If you have two people that have a pre-existing relationship, and maybe it's a marriage, or it might be a long-term power exchange relationship, or it may be a casual relationship, or whatever the configuration is, when you bring a new person in, they bring their own ideas of what a relationship is. If that person wants to be in a particular role with the other people, and that role supplants somebody that's already there or changes the dynamic with that person that's already there, there better be some good discussion because somebody's going to get their feelings hurt. It's important in that kind of case to determine whether if the new person coming in is dealing with a lot of new relationship energy directed at one person, that you not exclude the partner that's already in place. If you do that, there are going to be problems, and that will generally result in some sort of disharmony or disruption in the existing relationship. So that can be a deal breaker. Sometime a deal breaker would be in the practicalities of daytime life, like two people live in one house and the other person has a house and they don't want to leave it, or they have children and they need to have a special arrangement for those children. Or it may be that they don't have any money and they want to come into the house and they can't contribute. So any of those things can be a deal breaker. But if you do the discussion on the front end, you can determine that before you've established the relationship, which is really the time to do that. Because if you wait, it becomes more painful, more difficult.
Following on to that same question, how do you deal with disappointment and the loss of their current life?
That is a big issue for many people, especially if they're leaving a living relationship. If they have a home and they're being asked to move into another home, or they're going to give a substantial amount of time to a new relationship, but having to do so means they have to change how they deal with their personal space, time, free time, hobbies and interests, obligations outside of the relationship, it can be almost like a grief. You can have a little grief related to that. And it can be a down aspect of starting something new when you'd really want it to be very happy. But in doing so, as with any relationship, it's give and take, and that has to be negotiated.
I have seen when two people move in together and one leaves a residence and moves in with another person, just in a couple situation, it can be hard enough getting two people used to each other and the loss of a residence and that sort of thing. Then if you were to have that same thing in a three-person relationship, you then try to have two people that are stable enough, and then the third person coming in is experiencing these loss of their residence and all these things. I can see that that would be a really complex situation working three ways, because you're not just playing one person against another, you're playing it into a threesome.
I like the term you used, stabilizing, because stabilizing is a really big part of this. Once we establish relationships, the goal then is to stabilize them. And anytime you add a new person or a new dynamic, you are destabilizing the situation. And then you have to find a level ground again. You have to find some kind of stabilizing influence, stabilizing factors or circumstance that will bring that back into equilibrium again. To do that, you have to be aware of all the underlying factors. You have to talk a lot. Little things like pets are huge. If you have a cat and one of the people in the house has cat allergies, the cat may not be able to come. Or maybe you can't come because you won't be able to give up your cat, and you have to find a way to not be in the house but still be in the relationship. And I am really a big proponent of that. I don't think that poly people have to live under the same roof to have really good relationships. In fact, sometime, depending on the stage of your life, keeping your personal space and engaging in a relationship may be a better factor. It may be more stabilizing than to share space. Things like being under the same roof together but all having a separate room, where you have your things, your space, your private place, can be very reassuring.
Personal space is so critical to most relationships. And it just gets more complicated when you bring more people into a confined space.
Because people on top of each other are usually not very happy. If they're forced into proximity in a way that they're not comfortable with, it can bring out stress, anxiety. And so in order to avoid that, you have to find what's going to trigger stress and anxiety for people. And if it's too close a living environment, it may not be a good thing.
You can also look at the factor that if two of the people are at home and one of the person is at work, there can be a jealousy or time envy in there.
Time is huge. One of the things that happens if one person is a homemaker, male, female, doesn't matter, and they're at home, no matter how hard they're working, no matter what they're accomplishing, there is a fear that they're not going to be viewed as contributing enough because they're off. They're not working. Or it may be that they feel the burden on them is too great to be able to have any free time because they have to be busy taking care of everybody else. What happens sometime in those situations is the people that are working in a way feel like they have no way to come back and have their own private quiet time because there's somebody always there. That's a negotiation, and it's highly individualized according to the people that are involved.
And that really comes back to the personal space question. If that third person or even one of the other primary people needs to go into a private space to stabilize the situation, that is a required space in a house.
Exactly. And that includes the man cave and the women's bedrooms and the workshop in the basement or the gardening shed in the backyard. Those kind of spaces become havens, and everyone needs to have a personal haven because stress can cause you to want to escape sometime, but not to run away. Having a socially acceptable spot within your living environment where you can remove yourself to that space and have a moment to reflect, it can be very valuable and help to reduce stress.
Calgon, take me away.
Exactly. Yeah, closing that bathroom door and running the bathwater is a really good way to get a moment of clarity. I talked a little bit earlier about money. Money is a huge issue because we're all working hard all the time trying to keep ahead of the wolves, so to speak. And when you try to consolidate a household and bring more people in, everybody is usually asked to make some sort of contribution. Not everyone can always contribute equally. So that may be a case where someone contributes money because they don't have time. And another person will contribute time because they don't have money. And so you come up with an equitable arrangement.
And so that becomes a personal vision of fairness.
Yes. And if you're going to be sharing, you may not want to necessarily run a credit report on everybody, but you do want to know if someone in the situation is having issues with money or have difficulties with money so that if they're being expected to contribute into the household, that you're aware if that's a problem.
But you could certainly have perceptions of unfairness.
Unfairness brings me back to the equity principle. The equity theory says, in a nutshell, that anything has only the value that we assign to it and that the parties involved assign the value. So if you and I are having a conversation about something and it involves an issue of fairness, it doesn't matter who else in the world thinks something is fair or not fair. It only matters what you and I think. What do you think is fair? What do I think is fair? And is there a meeting place in the middle between us? Not in the very middle. It may be if you're very dominant and I'm a submissive person, that it's way over on your side where we find fairness and equity. But that has to happen with almost everything that we do when we're trying to establish harmony.
I can tell you 10 times that it's fair, but you may not believe it.
That's right. I have to believe it. I have to feel it. It has to feel right. And once we agree, that may change over time. But at least in that moment, we have established some equity. And equity is a driving force, and it can undo feelings of jealousy and envy. If everyone feels that the situation is fair, usually you don't have as much problem with envy and jealousy in a relationship.
It's extremely difficult to quantify equity, isn't it?
Right, because it's different for everyone and it's different in every situation. The theory was developed way back in the early part of the 20th century when they were looking at soldiers and promotions, and they studied it and found that the value that I assigned to the promotion I was given didn't really matter per se unless I perceived that it was better than the promotion that the guy next to me got. And that's a very simplified version, but essentially the value is assigned by factors that are not inherent in that thing. They're how you perceive it, how I perceive it, how I see it in relation to what you have. And so it's complicated. And it is also an aspect of relationships that will help you just totally diffuse bad things that are happening. If you can find a way to talk to each other, figure out what the great divide is on the issue, and then find where you start and I start, and then move toward a place along that continuum where we both think maybe we're both giving up more than we want, but maybe we're both getting a little more than we thought we might. And even if you don't feel like you want to negotiate with me, if you dig your heels in and say, this is a hard limit, I'm not going to talk anymore, the chance of getting that resolved is going to be reduced significantly. And this is very important in these complicated relationships.
So perception becomes a variable here. If everybody perceives that it's fair to themselves, that's fine. But if I perceive that you're not carrying the load or doing the work or whatever it is, then that perception is going to be a problem.
Right. If I don't speak up and tell you that it's a problem, we're not going to find harmony. We're not going to get equity. And that's why for submissive people, it can be more challenging. And so the burden shifts to the dominant person sometime to make sure, just make sure that you're getting that communication from the submissive person you're working with. Because if you don't, you may not ever get to the point of equity in that relationship.
Digging for the point of equity can often bring tears and breaking of fragile hearts.
Yes, and it's painful on all sides. And the harmony doesn't need to be, or the equity doesn't need to be, just between you and me. It also has to include all the other partners. Everyone has to perceive that it's fair. Because the bonds don't exist just between you and I if there are three people involved. They exist between you and I, you and another partner, me and that other partner. All those ties have to be fair. And that, you can already see, is a dynamic process. It is not something you decide it, you negotiate it, you do it one time, you write a contract, whatever it is, and then you're done. It's every day you're going to be doing these things. So it's infinitely more complicated than a monogamous relationship.
So let's look at equity in terms of the relationships. When you have a Y relationship, where you have three people of equal standing in the relationship, I can certainly see how this negotiation of equity could work. But then when you change the dynamic to a V, to where you have one common person and two independent people, so those two independents are each one in a relationship with the person at the base of the V, but they do not have a relationship necessarily with the two people at the top of the V. That could be a much more complicated negotiation of equity.
If you have a V relationship, it can be extremely challenging. And one of the reasons it can be challenging is often the two people that are at the ends of the V are not interacting with each other. And there often are dynamics with those individuals because of feeling relationship inequities or not knowing what's happening. That's really difficult for people. If you don't know what's happening in the relationship other than the part that you're participating in, it can be very destabilizing because the things that people in these poly type relationships typically fear is abandonment and loss of their relationship. Anxiety is already high in some of those cases. And if you are not talking to the other people involved, it can be more complicated. Now, presumably in a poly relationship that meets the consensually non-monogamous definition, those people know about each other. There's no secret that they're there. Maybe a way to resolve it is to develop some sort of a non-relationship relationship with them, that there's an open channel of communication in some way, whether they choose to pursue it or not, that they can get their questions answered, or they can either do it in writing is a good way. If they're not comfortable talking to each other, having a touch-based phone call from time to time, deciding on the front end what issues are important that need to be discussed whenever certain dynamics change, they have to be agreed upon. It's really tough when there's a marriage involved and two people are married and one is not, because that just feels so much to people like cheating, even if it's not, when everybody knows. And that's typically where you see a lot of anxiety arise, is when there's an outside party that's coming in, and that person's uncomfortable because they think they're shut out of the relationship if there's not communication and there's not a three-way relationship existing. But on the marriage side, it feels like their partner is being pulled away So it can be an anxiety-producing situation. In those kind of cases, you just have to find some ways to communicate, even if it doesn't mean you talk to each other, if you send a note back and forth, whatever that relationship can tolerate.
As long as the person at the bottom of the V isn't the message carrier.
Exactly. There needs to be a direct channel of communication between those two people, even if they choose not to use it, that they're allowed to communicate. If they're allowed to communicate, it really takes the anxiety down a notch.
What is the role of negotiation and agreements in a poly relationship?
Well, particularly in a lot of poly kink relationships, you actually have people that write contracts. And I'm not a big fan of written contracts, but I've actually written some things like that before to define a relationship in the early stages. So if you want something to refer back to, you can. I would say those kind of things are great in the moment they're executed or the moment they're spoken. But if you intend to then hold that person to that agreement over a long course of time, you are probably going to have some disappointment on all sides because people change and these relationships change and evolve over time. If you don't evolve the agreements along with them, you're going to have a piece of paper that has cobwebs all over it, just cobwebs, and it's not going to fit. It's going to be antiquated for that relationship, and no one will be happy with it.
I think I'm more fond of the term making an outline of what the relationship should be and the direction it should go in, and instead of binding it to some kind of contract, because first off, they're not binding anyway.
Right. I find just ongoing touch-based conversations really work well. Had one last night talking about aspects of things that we agreed to long ago, just bring them up and talking about them again. And I actually, in the course of the conversation, said, you know, if you met me today, would you still be interested in having this relationship, given everything that you know about me and how I think and how I am? And the answer was yes. So I think that's an affirming thing. It could have very well been no, in which case then we would have more conversations to have.
And kind of ugly ones.
Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they would be exploring some things. They might be pretty ugly, but they would be interesting nonetheless. And the other thing I wanted to say there is that every time you bring somebody new in or someone leaves a relationship or you change the nature of the relationship, you have to go back over all those agreements again because they will not be applied in the same way when you change the partners. Anybody new coming in has their own set of things that they want to talk about and bring into the situation, and then you'll have to negotiate again anyway.
And I think the same holds true when they go out the door. All kinds of duties change and expectations change.
With age, as we age in place in our relationships, those things will have to change too because people's health changes. Their jobs change, their money changes, their interests change.
And their capabilities.
Their capabilities change, exactly. And so, you know, those things are all things that have to be addressed as we evolve these relationships.
It would be interesting to have a what-if clause in the negotiations. What if a person is laid up or in the hospital or has a terminal disease? How does that affect the relationship?
I think we're all afraid to go there when we're just talking. And yet those are very important things to talk about. And we do talk about them when there's a formalized relationship like a marriage. It doesn't happen so much in these other types of relationships. But it's fruitful, and especially because so many people in this relationship context, as a demographic, these evolved poly relationships also involve older people. Not always, but quite a few are older, more advanced in their relationships, more evolved, if you will. But as a general rule, in marriages, we may have those kind of conversations, but we may not routinely have those conversations in poly relationships because they are often seen by the participants as in the moment. Even if they expect to last a long time, we still treat them very much in the moment. And yet we have a lot of participants who are long-time participants in these relationships. And as we change, we see our partners changing. It would be valuable for people to have these conversations because if you don't have a legal relationship, you may not even be allowed to go into the room of a person that you're involved with at the hospital if they're critically ill. So those things need to be examined.
It's funny you should mention that. I recently had a friend in the ICU at the hospital, and I went in there and they asked who I was. I said, I'm her brother. And I walked in the room. You know, that worked that time, but I didn't have anything official that would allow me to go in and see somebody that I cared about. So that's a real critical thing.
Yeah, the answer can sometimes be as simple as having a living will that specifies the people that are important to you as decision makers. That alone can sometimes leapfrog over a lot of this other complication.
So there really is a call for a certain amount of paperwork in these relationships.
Right. If you're going to do them long-term or you're going to share space, if there is property involved, bills to be paid, and the daily grind of living is part of all this, you do need to make arrangements for the people that you're with so that if you're not able to participate in the decision-making process, the process can carry forward. I think that that does involve some paperwork. There's not much way around it. And it is a way of formalizing the relationship.
We're going to take a quick break and hear from our friends at NCSF. We'll be back with Sheba's Vessel in a moment.
Jason here with the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom. Did you know the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom is here to help you when you are being discriminated against because you're kinky? NCSF helps groups and events that are being talked about in the media. We help people find kink-aware lawyers when there is a child custody dispute or someone needs help with a civil or criminal problem. We also help kinky businesses stay on the right side of the law, from pro-doms to fetish clubs. You too can ask for help from the National Coalition of Sexual Freedom Incident Reporting and Response Program. Visit us at ncsfreedom.org.
How does conflict management work in a poly relationship?
Well, I gave you some of the tools for conflict management when we talked about equity. If you just keep that principle, the equity theory, the concept of equity in mind when you're trying to talk to people in your relationship, you'll find that will take you far down the road. You'll have a tool that will help you weed through some of these things. There is a great book that I'd like to recommend called Redefining Our Relationships by Wendy O'Matic. It's a very small book, but it's wonderful. It has a lot of tools, very short, to the point ways to diffuse situations and look at situations in your relationships. And if you take the time to read that, I think it's like a little handbook that you can use as a workbook. And I've had two copies of it, and one copy I have so much written in it that I can't even read it anymore. So I moved on to another copy at this point. This kind of thing, finding a tool that helps you be in touch with your feelings and in touch with the areas of conflict that could arise. More than anything, knowing yourself, knowing your hot buttons, the ones that you have that are easy to push, will help you a lot with your partners. Because if you know what your hot buttons are, it's harder for somebody to trigger them with that. You're being aware that it's going to happen. You can get ahead of it a little bit. And then you can make a roadmap for how to resolve those problems. And I think your partners need to do the same thing. Through those discussions, they maybe don't need to be private. Maybe they need to be conversations that you have together to know each other better. But journaling is really good too. It's a good way. If there are always things that you don't want to share with your partners, maybe you're not even comfortable writing them down. Even if it's you write the question down and you think about it and just really give it some processing, you'll be better prepared the next time you have a conflict to deal with. Scheduling regular time to just talk about the status of the relationship is very important. And that needs to be neutral so that it's not done in the middle of a conflict already flying, but a time away when you just do that relationship building. Because then when you get into a conflict-driven situation, you'll have some tools that you can draw on.
Okay, since we're talking about conflicts, let's jump off the end here and go into jealousy and envy.
Probably two of the things that I hear more about than anything else from poly people that I know. Some recent conversations that I've read in chat rooms and groups online talking about this issue deal with them in very different ways. I look at jealousy and envy as symptoms of a problem that needs to be resolved either within the person that's feeling it or within the relationship where it's expressing itself. Part of the research that I'm doing looks at that in poly relationships, but I will say that there's some difficulty in studying those kind of things because people are not always honest about how they feel when you ask them a question directly. So trying to get at how people feel is sometimes very challenging. If you talk to people about jealousy and envy in the abstract, they'll be viewed as negative emotions you should never experience, and you should aspire not to feel that. In some way, it's a character flaw if you have feelings of jealousy and envy. But the bottom line is, people feel those things. They are human emotions, and people feel them to differing degrees. And knowing yourself and understanding what triggers that for you is very, very important. There are a lot of underlying psychological theories about why we feel jealousy and envy the way we do and how it expresses. But it boils down to everybody has triggers in this area that bring these feelings about. Now, some people don't feel them very much. They don't trigger very easily, or only a few situations will do it for them. Other people are very vulnerable, and they have a lot of trouble with it. If you have a lot of trouble with it, poly is going to be hard for you because you're going to face it all the time. You're going to deal with those kind of things. And there's not a feeling of secure comfort where there are no challenges most of the time. It's always going to be a little off balance, and you're always going to be negotiating. But if you look at jealousy and envy, as I described as symptoms, it will help you to dig into the underlying problems that you may have in your relationship.
But envy is not really a problem because it's one of the seven deadly sins, and so you can't have it.
Says you. If you would take away all the expectations that people have about how they should feel or how they shouldn't feel, and just probed if they've ever had these kind of feelings, most people will have had them in some situation, and it just depends on how much they've been able to avoid those situations or limit their exposure to them or find a way to not express it, even if they're feeling it.
Earlier, you said that when you're asking about it, you're not necessarily going to get an honest answer. You got two things you're dealing with, a heart and a head. The head can rationalize it and say, well, I shouldn't be jealous or I shouldn't be envious of the situation, and the heart is breaking. That's a conflict within one individual, and now you're trying to bring it into three people.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about jealousy, particularly, is that there are even physiological things about jealousy that go back to our attachment as children, just small children when we were not able to even verbalize, that our physiological response to certain situations that came about actually have predisposed us to behave in a certain way. So it's very difficult to overcome your biology sometime. If you have someone who's been in repeated situations where they've been exposed to abandonment as a small child or to rejection or emotional coldness, some of those kind of things, where they didn't receive what they needed at different points as they developed, they are probably going to have more difficulty with this. I mean, not always, but they have potential to have more problem with it. Somebody who's from a very secure situation where they've never had to deal with any of those kind of things, and they have had been able to set those aside, has probably not had that experiential physiological reaction to jealousy.
And I think we all have potential of being emotionally broken at some point. You know, somewhere along the line, the love of your life has jilted you, and that is then going to be the basis of an explosion to come.
Right, or ability to withdraw and push away the person that's close to you because that's your defense. Some people run toward their fear and some people run away from it. And knowing your partners and how they respond in those situations will help you to do a better job responding. We all have patterns of behavior and we all have triggers. We just need to know our partner and what those are and figure out whether we can tolerate them. And if so, how do we help them?
The dangerous position on this team is the one with the striped shirt and the whistle.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be that person.
Not in one of the three, at any rate.
Correct. We don't want to be an arbiter in our own relationship because we are all too close to it to be able to play referee.
And it's really ugly to bring in an independent fourth party in this case.
True. But sometime it may be necessary. Actually, if you have the ongoing conversations and discussions and there's good communication, there's probably less of a chance to have it blow up that way, but it's not impossible that it would blow up that way, even with all the best intentions and everything done right.
In the event that a couple or a triad needs relationship management, NCSF has a listing of kink-friendly professionals that is a very valuable asset that can allow you to find a counselor, marriage counselor, a relationship counselor that can give a point of view that we can't see because the forest for the trees.
Correct. And if you've ever tried to go to a counselor who doesn't have that background and then leveled this stuff on them and watched their eyes roll around and be speechless, and I have had that experience, it's very frustrating because when you know more about those things than the person who's trying to give you counsel, it's extremely difficult. But I did want to say one thing. There are many more people being trained in this area right now, and there are lots of publications coming out in the scholarly community regarding poly relationships. There are some wonderful publications coming out right now. There's one I just received, Elizabeth Sheff's new book, The Polyamorous Next Door. Haven't even finished reading everything in the book yet. It's wonderful. And she'll be speaking in June in Atlanta at One Poly Conference there. So there's an opportunity to actually hear her speak as well. And she's a recognized expert in this area and working on aspects of not only the research about us, poly people, but also counseling and helping people who are poly to work through their issues.
You've named two really good books, which will be on our Hot Links page under episode 13. By the way, you're lucky 13. What else do you have in your pile of books there?
I have a great book on the communication of jealousy that also just came out by Jennifer Bevan. And this book is more of a scholarly work. It's more research, but there's some great stuff in there about how we as communicators deal with jealousy. This book on communication of jealousy is extremely valuable because it deals with some of the new trends in how we communicate in this very touchy realm, and it's one of my research interests.
Change happens. What now?
I think we all know people who've been married for long periods of time, and all of a sudden one day they announce to their friends, "We're not together anymore. We're going our separate ways." They may say, "We're getting a divorce." They may say they're separating. It may be that they're moving down the hall to a separate bedroom. Same thing happens with poly relationships. There are certainly more long-term poly relationships out in the community now than I have seen in the past, but they tend to be a bit fragile. And you may see the core of poly relationships stay the same with, say, some core participants with change within the partnerships that maybe are not primary. And in that particular case, we don't have a lot of ritual for those breakups as we do in other areas of our culture. Although I did actually go to an uncollaring ceremony one time where the collar was burned. It was all a big dramatic event and very ritualized. But typically we don't see that. And so people sort of fade in and out of these relationships and they're not formalized per se. But I think that whenever you have that kind of change occur, if you can't move past it, if the relationship will not work any longer for whatever reason, everyone needs to come back to the table and they need to reconfigure everything. They need to talk about it, reestablish what their parameters are, and then move forward. Because if you don't do that, more problems will result.
And put their feelings in neutral for the time.
Right, because there is going to be some, in some cases, hostility, anger, resentment, or sadness, just great sadness. One of the things that happens is that sometimes you may have a partner that dies. And, the loss is hard anyway, but within a relationship, the loss of a partner, no matter what their role is going to be just devastating. So we need to acknowledge change and not just let it happen and not respond. We need to find a way to be neutral, take stock, and then step back and reengage.
Well, this has been fantastic, a talk about poly here in your second installment in your series, and I look forward to seeing what your next one is.
I hope it'll be exciting.
Today on the Kinky Cast, we've had Shiva's Vessel, and we thank her for putting in a great amount of time on the concept of poly.
What I'd like to see with poly is that it just become accepted and that people will be able to do it easily, or at least more easily. And that we'll see it become a more mainstream concept in our culture.
And see the judgment go away. And on that note, thank you so much for coming, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Take it away, Max.
You have been listening to episode 13 of the Kinky Cast. Today we heard Shiva's Vessel. See our Hot Links page for the referenced books. We want to hear from you with your comments or questions. So email us, questions@kinkycast.com, or call and leave a voicemail at 916-KINKY69. If you leave a contact number, we will try to reach you to join us on the show. Some listeners want to remain completely anonymous, so we have the Bashful tab on our webpage. Just type your message and hit send. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Cassie, I'm Max. See you next week when we venture out.